Hello, everybody. Happy Sunday. I am so excited to be going through the book of Psalms in here on Sunday mornings with you all. It's this Old Testament collection of poems and writings and rants and songs, and it's so raw and real. I just love it. And today we're going to look at two separate psalms, Psalm 36 and Psalm 137, and together they address the words in my title, scarcity, abundance, and glory days. Let's start with scarcity and abundance. I just want to read two verses out of Psalm 36 today. It says this: Your love, Lord, reaches to the heavens, your faithfulness to the skies. Your righteousness is like the highest mountains, your justice like the great deep. You, Lord, preserve both people and animals. I want to talk about scarcity and abundance right now and how it relates to the verses we just read. Author and researcher Brené Brown says that our particular culture in the United States has a never enough problem. And I totally agree with her. We are constantly being told that there is not enough in our lives, even though we live in one of the richest countries in the world. Ads tell us, hey, you don't have enough of this particular product, so you must rush out right now and buy more of it while our fake sale is still going on. And then politicians tell us all the time, hey, other people are going to come into our country and they're going to steal your jobs and you will not have enough money. You'll lose everything unless you vote for me. Okay, that's their basic message. And then news outlets tell us, hey, this strike or this particular natural disaster is probably going to cause shortages. And then our brains go all Lord of the Flies again and think, shortages? Well, I've got to go out and collect all of the toilet paper and paper towels and hoard that for myself once again. We get sucked in to the never enough mindset so often. We freak out and fret about our perceived lack of so many things like money, time, love, and others. The list goes on. Here's the scary part. When our personal safety is something that we feel there's not enough of, that's when it gets scary in our life. Because when we think we don't have enough safety, that's when we start building walls and not bridges, both personally and as a country. And we become xenophobic. We fear those that we label as other or as a stranger because they might take something from us. And we actually tend to use the strangers in our lives as a scapegoat for our fear of scarcity. I'll give you a classic example, World War I. After World War I, I'm a history buff, Germany was a mess. It got decimated in World War I, and it was a mess. People were suffering from a prolonged recession, and nostalgia for their past was at an all-time high because their future seemed kind of hopeless and scary. They were afraid their current scarcity might stick around for a while. Well, along comes Hitler, and what does Hitler do? He points his finger at the Jews and says, "Your never enough problem is their fault. You get rid of them, you'll get rid of your scarcity." And we know what happened next. So the fear of scarcity actually fueled an atrocity, and it still does to this day. So let me mention a few things about scarcity. First of all, sometimes there actually is actual scarcity. We live on a fallen, sin-saturated planet. So because of things like wars and inequity and racism and natural disasters, sometimes people experience a lack. They experience scarcity. Those are the moments when those of us currently experiencing abundance need to step up and help out. I was reading a story the other day out of a book about an orca, a killer whale named Tumbo. And I liked the name and it grabbed my attention. I kept reading it. And Tumbo was actually this orca, and a very rare orca, because he had scoliosis. And the scoliosis enabled him to swim but not keep up with his family and his pod. He would always fall behind. And so he couldn't hunt. He wasn't eating enough. He was experiencing scarcity in his life. And the pod did something amazing. One at a time, after they would go on hunts, they would go back and feed Tumbo. they would take turns feeding Tumbo out of their pod and make sure he had enough. And they did this for a decade. For 10 years, they made sure that Tumbo didn't experience any scarcity until Tumbo passed away. If killer whales can figure out how to do this, how to help others in scarcity, we as humans should be able to as well. Look at this verse that Paul writes in 2 Corinthians. But since you excel in everything, in faith and speech and knowledge, in complete earnestness, and in the love we have kindled in you, see to it that you also excel in the grace of giving. This is an invitation to all of us to excel, to get really, really good at giving, to get rid of our fear of scarcity and embrace generosity. And in the process, when we embrace generosity, the people around us will notice that we live a life of generosity, and they'll start to want to change their life too. We'll actually show them how to keep enough for our need, but not enough for our greed. And that's such a better way to live. To live that way is really to live, it's to swim in the divine flow of an abundant God. More on the abundant God stuff later. Second thing I want to say about scarcity is most of the time, scarcity is imagined and not real. Have you ever noticed that the most valuable things in your life are actually fairly common? Things like bread and air and water and people and puppies and trees and love, the list goes on. Yeah, sometimes we are convinced that we're in times of scarcity because of what other voices speak to us, when actually we're blessed beyond belief with all of these common and yet wonderful things in our life. And that makes me realize that gratitude is actually the antidote for scarcity, because when we take stock of all that we actually have, we won't have the emotional bandwidth to worry about what other people are telling us that we need. And the last thing I want to say about scarcity is this: with God, there is only abundance. The verses that we read out of Psalm 36 today point to the fact that God is a God of abundance and not scarcity. Look at the language that's used. God's love is so vast, it's said to reach to the heavens. God's faithfulness is so big, it stretches also to the skies. God's righteousness is compared to these big, beautiful, mighty, majestic mountains, and God's justice is as deep as the ocean. Everything about God is big and vast and abundant. That's God's very nature. I used a prayer in here months ago from a Monty Python movie, and if you're not old enough to remember Monty Python, you can Google it. Most of it's really good. Some of it's going to disturb you. Okay, just a warning, a little heads up on that, okay? But there was this one episode in Monty Python where a vicar, a pastor, a priest, had this great prayer. You remember this? I'm going to put it up on the screen. He said this: "Oh Lord, you are so big, so absolutely huge. You are so strong and well, just so super." That was his prayer, and I thought, that is perfect, okay? Perfect. It's funny, but it's true. And God demonstrates God's abundant nature oftentimes all throughout the Bible. John 21, Jesus has been resurrected from the dead, and he shows up at a lake where some of his friends were fishing, and they were failing. They couldn't catch a thing, which sounds like my day fishing. And he gives them a few tips, and they catch so many fish, it almost swamps their boat. There's God and abundance going together. Or in John chapter 2, they run out of wine at a wedding, which was a disgrace at that time, and Jesus turns water into wine, but not just a few cups of wine or even a few bottles. They estimate that he made 30 to 50 gallons of wine. That's a lot of wine, and it was really good wine. There's God and abundance going together again. And Ephesians chapter 1, it says this, that we are all blessed with all of the spiritual blessings of heaven. Not some, not just a few of the blessings of heaven, all of the blessings. God doesn't skimp. There is no shortage, no scarcity with God, and there never will be. And when we remember and meditate on the fact that God is a God of abundance, it actually causes us to look at our lives through a lens of abundance instead of scarcity and a frightened self-interest. So I think before I move on to my last point in this sermon today, we should pray the Monty Python prayer out loud over our lives today. today. So we're going to do it. Here you go. Okay? Are you ready? I'll start us on three. One. Oh, you have to pray this fairly loud, too, so you can hear yourself pray it. One, two, three. Oh, Lord, you are so big, so absolutely huge. You are so strong and, well, just so super. Can we say amen to that? All right, let's move on to glory days. I'm going to read Psalm 137 in its entirety. Don't freak out. It's 9 verses. You can make it through this, okay? And then I'll talk about glory days. I have to get over here. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars, we hung our harps. For there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. Sing us one of the songs of Jerusalem. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you. If I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction. Happy is the one who repays you according to what you have done to us. Happy is the one who seizes your babies and dashes them against the rocks. Well, kumbaya, isn't this just a happy-sounding psalm, okay? Many people read this psalm and they go, how did that make the cut? Why is that even in the Bible? I have to admit, for years, I would read through the psalms, I'd get to this one and go, skip, and just go to the next one, because I found it so offensive and horrible, okay? Because it starts out sad, and it ends up awful. Absolutely awful. Please let me share a few things out of this psalm that are going to make you so glad that it was put in the Bible, okay? It'll actually make you glad. And a little shout out to one of my favorite authors, Nadia Boltz, for a couple of these insights. First thing about this psalm is not prescriptive. Does God want us to take the babies of the people that we perceive to be our enemies and dash them against the rocks? Is there a blessing attached to that behavior? Was there ever a blessing attached to that behavior? No. And ew, God is not like that. God does not support that kind of behavior. Bible literalists will say he does, and that's not true at all. What's happening here is the psalm writer is simply venting some very raw, real, and strong emotions and getting them out of himself. It's not a prescription of how we're supposed to live. Now, let's talk about glory days and how it relates to this psalm. People mostly refer to their glory days in their life as the ages of 18 to 30. Some of you are older than that, some of you are young, or in your glory days, so-called glory days right now. As I look back on the glory days of my life, there was definitely some good things. I'm 61 next month, but there is definitely some good things basically in my 20s. First of all, my younger body. Man, I miss my younger body. I could dunk a basketball with two hands behind my head. I can't even touch the rim anymore, I don't think, okay? I just miss how bendy it was and not sick all the time and stuff like that. I miss my younger body. No cell phones. Ah, it was great in my glory days. People actually paid attention to you, not their phone. And then TVs in my era of glory days, they were so much easier to work. One remote. I know that blows your mind if you're a young person. One remote with a volume and 3 channels. That's all you had. It was so simple, everybody could work it. And then, of course, there was music in my decade. Come on. Tom Petty, Boston, Pablo Cruz, the list goes on. And every generation believes their music was the best, but mine was, okay? And then lastly, in my decade of glory days, I'm kidding you not, and if you're below 50, you're not going to believe this, you could, if you got sick, you could call your doctor, your own personal doctor, and see that doctor sometimes the same day. And if not, maybe a day later. You didn't have to wait. Like, I got an appointment with my doctor, and it was 3 months later. Three? Okay, I'm not even going to say. Okay, but these glory days, like everybody's glory days, are not actually all that glorious because there is some bad stuff going on. In my decade of glory days, there was even more racism in the United States than there is now. Hard to believe, but there was. There was more sexism by far than there is now. There was more exclusion of LGBTQ people, and we had metal dashboards that didn't have airbags. If you got in a wreck, conk, that was it, okay? And then duck football, we're celebrating how good it was. It was awful in my decade. Awful. You could buy a general admission ticket and sit on the 40-yard line because nobody was there. They were that bad, okay? What's all this have to do with Psalm 37? That's a great question. I'm glad you asked, and I'm going to tell you. Check it out. The people in this psalm actually no longer lived in Jerusalem. They used to, but they didn't anymore. They had been taken away as exiles and forced to live in Babylon. So they are weeping as they remember their past, their glory days when they lived in Jerusalem. They were so sad that it said they hung up their harps. Have you ever had a week like that? Where it just seems like every day there's something sad happens to you, and you finally get to the point where you go, I am hanging up my harp. I am just hanging up my harp. I have no song of joy left in my soul. That's how they felt. It is so easy for people to weep when they reflect on their past, and maybe that's true of you. Because maybe your past, even a short while ago, was a time when you felt like you belonged. It was a time when you felt like you were happy. Maybe it was a time when your loved ones were still alive and with you and they aren't anymore. And you, when you reflect on that, you can weep as you feel the loss of things from your past. But here's the thing. There's this super smart guy. He is a biblical scholar and his name's Walter Brueggemann. He is so smart. Doesn't that sound smart? I actually feel smarter for saying his name. Walter Brueggemann. Try it at home. You'll just feel smart. And he has this great insight. He points out that in Psalm 137, the people that were in exile in Psalm 137 actually used to be the elites of the society in Jerusalem when they lived back in Jerusalem. So their view of the glory days was askew because they lived in Jerusalem in what they thought were glory days, but that's because they existed in a position of power and prestige. Their view was askew. It's kind of like when you talk to an introvert about the pandemic. Have you ever done that? I thought the pandemic was the most horrible, dark period of my life. It felt apocalyptic, especially when the fire and the ash was coming down. I go, oh, it's the end of the world. Okay. And I had to preach into a phone. It was the most miserable time in my life. I need people. I need you. I need connection more than just one or two. But I've talked to introverts and they actually say, I go, well, what was the pandemic like for you? They go, it was awesome. It was awesome. I worked at home. I played at home. I stayed at home. I ordered my food in. I got to wear a mask. Nobody had to look at my face. It was so great that you can't wait for the next one, okay? I'm not lying to you. They absolutely had the time of their lives. It's just, it's unbelievable to me. That's how these elites were. Was their view of Jerusalem and the glory days of Jerusalem accurate? No, not at all. Because elsewhere in the Bible, people paint a far more dire picture of what life in Jerusalem was like at that time. It might have been great for the elites, but it was miserable for the widow, the orphan, the poor, and the outcast. Yeah, they looked back longingly at this time as their glory days, but other people did not. Now, the ending of Psalm 137 is brutal and awful. So I want you to see how Psalm 137 progresses. It starts with nostalgia, and this is important. It starts with nostalgia, moves to weeping, and then it moves on to people trying to co-opt God into violence against the babies of the people of those who they view as responsible for its taking their glory days away from them. So there's the process, nostalgia, weeping, trying to co-opt God into the violence of the people towards the people that stole their glory days. Check out what Brueggemann says about this process. You're gonna like this. Excessive nostalgia for a past that never actually existed will lead to violence against those who have taken from us what we falsely remember, as in make Jerusalem great again. And he was not trying to make a political point there, okay? All righty. He's saying, if you focus on nostalgia all the time, you'll get so mad at the people that you thought took your glory days away from you, you'll actually become violent towards them. So Psalm 137, although it sounds brutal, and it actually is, offers us some great wisdom. The first bit of wisdom is this: don't long so much for the past that you forget what you have now. My past was great. My glory days were great in my eyes, for several reasons. First of all, because I have conveniently forgotten the rotten stuff, but also because I tend to underestimate the present. Don't we all? We underestimate the present. I have some incredible things in my life right now that I didn't have in my so-called glory days. My wife, my kids, the wisdom that only comes from aging, okay? All those things. I have a church community that I now just adore. You guys didn't have you in my glory days. I have old friends. In my glory days, I had just all new friends. I had them for like maybe a year or two. I have friends that I've been friends with for decades now. That is so amazingly precious. Why can't these be the glory days? I keep thinking to myself, and they can. So Psalm 137 is actually all about the fear of change. And most people, no matter how old you are, you fear change. This people in Psalm 137, the elites, definitely feared change. They longed for the glory days because those days were known, they were predictable, they were safe. So the second bit of wisdom we have out of this psalm is this: ask God to get you over your fear of change. Oh, and that's an important prayer. Please, I beg of you, pray that in your life. Ask God to get you over your fear of change. That way, when people come into your life, and they will, who challenge your status quo, who challenge your doctrines, your beliefs, your very faith, your comfort zones, if you're not afraid of change, you won't view them as the enemy. If you are afraid of change, you're in danger of viewing them as the enemy, and you'll be tempted to vilify them to the point where you try to co-opt God into causing them great pain. You might not pray, God, please bring people in their life to take their babies and dash them against rocks. Okay, you might not do that. But you might engage in Schadenfreude, where you really hope for pain to come their way, and when it does, you secretly celebrate it. That's what happens when we're afraid of change. We vilify the people who might bring it into our lives. And it doesn't have to be this way. And I'll end with this, and this is so cool. I am so geeking out on this psalm, okay? But this is so cool. When the Babylonian exile ended, and the people were allowed to go back to their homeland and to Jerusalem and live, some of the exiles didn't. They decided to stay in Babylon instead, which is remarkable. Somewhere along the line, they embrace the change. They embrace their change of neighbors and location and lifestyles, and they stopped vilifying all of the Babylonians, and they stayed there, and they made this whole new life. And because of this, I won't give you all the gory details, but because of this, Babylon, instead of being an awful place, ended up being a major religious center for Jewish people during this time. And God did amazing things there. And I believe God will do the same in our life. When we're grateful for our glory days, but we're not afraid of new days, when we stop vilifying those who challenge us and embrace them as friends instead.